You really want to be better with your finances. You try to put money away in savings. You look for deals. You wrote out a budget once a long time ago. You still overdraft from time to time and you still have debt. The truth is managing money is not easy, but Rocket Money can help. Rocket Money shows you exactly what you're spending every month. From there, the app helps you make a budget that meets your financial goals. The app even gives you real-time alerts when you're about to go over your budget so you don't spend too much. With Rocket Money, you can also see all your subscriptions at a glance and cancel the ones you don't want right from the app. Rocket Money can even try to get you a refund for some of the money you wasted. Plus, you can use the Smart Savings feature to start putting more money away. Rocket Money analyzes your accounts to determine the optimal time to stow away cash without going over your budget. Our members report that the Rocket Money app saved more than $700 a year. Getting better with money doesn't have to be a pipe dream. Rocket Money can make it a reality. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel or download the app from the Apple app or Google Play stores.
These guys were made in different restaurants where the bad guys were trying to convince them to pay the money that they owed. And they met at a restaurant called, and I love the name of this restaurant. I need to use it in a book one day, Benny the Bums. So they would meet at the restaurant. And at one point, they take him into the bathroom. Now I got them all wired up and I even got a transmitter on them. We're out in the parking lot listening to the threats that are being made. Well, they take them into the bathroom and made them strip. They were doing a strip search and they had a wand that indicated that the wand lit up, like they said, like a Christmas tree. And so they knew something was going on. And so they ended the meeting. We had met with them at least twice before and had gotten these consensual recordings of the threats.
Hey gang, welcome back to part two of this week's episode with Jerry Williams, retired FBI special agent, 26 years working for the federal government, kicking butt and taking names. Don't get in a boxing match with her because if you tick her off, she's going to whoop your ass. That's what's going to happen. So Jerry, thank you so much for coming back.
Oh, it was a pleasure. We had so much fun. Why wouldn't I want to continue?
Exactly. And I'll tell you what, I'm smiling and laughing more than normal here. So that means it's a good interview for me. Yeah. So just to get back into it, she is out of the academy. She goes to Sacramento, spends about 18 months there. And then when you went to Philly, did you volunteer or did they force you to move there?
Oh, this is another good story. Okay. So for some reason, I mean, most of the time when you transfer from when you're getting a transfer, during that time period, you go to a small or medium sized office and you know you're going to have to now go to a large office, but you're usually in that small to medium sized office for at least 2 or 3 years. I mean, makes sense, you know, as far as funding and transfer money that people be there. But for some reason, everybody that came through the academy in 1982, 83, they only kept us in our first office for 18 months.
Wow.
So I get this notification that we're going to be transferred, which, of course, I was very happy because I didn't want to be in Sacramento anymore anyway. And there were some more stories about Sacramento that we'll talk about at another time. But so, you know, I get notice that they're going to transfer us and would we do a list of where we might want to go, you know? So I make the list and Philadelphia is number one. Now it's number one because I went to college in Baltimore. I'm from, I was born in DC, had relatives in DC, relatives in Virginia. And I just thought Philadelphia was cool. I had been there a couple of times. So Philadelphia was number one, Baltimore, DC, all of that. I send off the email, or it wasn't an email, it was an Airtel, but I send off the memo to headquarters about where I would like to get transferred. And a few days later, I get my transfer order and it's dated the same day as the memo that I had sent to headquarters. So they never saw it.
Okay.
And it's Philadelphia. And the joke was, as soon as they get my memo and realize they gave me what I want, they got to resend my orders. Oh my God, we actually gave somebody what they wanted. How did that happen?
That sounds like DEA too.
So yeah, so Philadelphia was my number one choice. Nobody knew it at the, nobody, I mean, absolutely no way did they know that at the transfer office, but I got what I wanted. So excellent, I was very excited about that.
And I forgot to ask you yesterday, in the academy, did you fill out a wish list?
In the academy, we probably did too. And I probably had offices. I don't remember, but we probably did. And I had offices, would have had offices on the East Coast. And I got Sacramento.
Yeah, that's close.
Yeah, it's close. And there was a guy in my class. He had four kids. He lived in San Francisco and he got Richmond. So oh, it was man. Like, what are they doing?
You know? Yes.
It doesn't make any sense whatsoever.
Yeah, we used to have a joke that in agent assignment and headquarters, you know, they'd bring out a bottle of wine or a bottle of champagne or alcohol, whatever, get a little toddy going there, and then take darts and throw at the map. Okay, who's up next?
Yeah, we say the same thing, but it's not one of the, you know, officials that does it. It's a blind monkey. A blind monkey with a dart.
I like it. I like it. There's probably a lot of truth to that.
It sounds like it. I mean, when you look at the wish list sometimes and where people end up, I hear it's a little bit better now. But, you know.
Well, I know for DEA, because the Academy invites my old DEA partner, Javier Pena, and I a couple of times a year to talk to the basic agent trainees. And, you know, we do it one evening after dinner for a couple hours in the training room. And I love doing it because you just get to meet all these studs and studettes that are getting ready to have the time of their life. They don't realize how much fun they're about to have. But when I went through, and this is 87, you submitted five offices, and one of those had to be a division office. And so I put down, you know, the great places in Norfolk, Virginia, Wilmington, North Carolina, Charleston, South Carolina, Jacksonville, Florida, and Miami Division. Of course, got Miami Division, which was the best thing that could have happened. Just had a blast down there. But now what they do is you know where you're going to be assigned before you ever step foot in the academy.
Wow.
Yeah, because they had so many people that were going through. And then they'd get, you know, just like you, they were from the East Coast and got the West Coast or vice versa or just whatever. And they would quit. And this is after the government's already invested all this money in right. your background and your training. And so they might not quit immediately, but some do. And then some would wait that year and then they quit.
Yeah. During the time that I came through, there were a number of agents that quit because they got New York and they didn't want to go to New York. And that is, you know, that's really sad. So this makes a lot of sense because, you know, they say that transfers are based on the needs of the office or the needs of the bureau. But right. a lot of times you have somebody, you know, that has an accounting degree, you know, or some, you know, a language specialty, and they're going someplace that doesn't even need that. Yeah. So we all know that that's not true.
Yeah, you know? I don't know that there's any real rhyme or reason as to how they make these decisions other than the blind monkey.
Yeah, blind monkey.
I like that.
So it would be better if they knew ahead of time. And then, you know, I mean, you still wasted money on the background investigation, but at least you don't have to go through the training and lose that spot, you know,
yeah.
for somebody who's not going to actually follow through.
You know, I don't know what the dollar figure is now, but I know later in life, as I was transferring with DEA, I transferred seven or eight times throughout my career, that the average cost was about $100,000 a move. Mm. So it's, I mean, you know, you're not talking about chump change. It's a significant amount of money. Yeah. Okay. So we got you in Philly. And what was the first squad that you were assigned to there?
It was a government fraud squad. It was a government fraud squad, and the supervisor was in-house supervisor, meaning that he had been an agent on the bank robbery squad and now was a government fraud supervisor. And a lot of the people on his squad were, you know, also, you know, from that squad. It just was not a good fit, you know. And a lot of it was I just was not the type of person that could keep my mouth shut when I saw things are, you know, were not being done fairly. And so I probably voiced my opinion on something that had happened. And, you know, next thing I know, I've been, you know, moved to another operation that was happening out in our Cherry Hill office temporarily. And that didn't work out well either. You know, I had to take some responsibility because obviously I wasn't playing the game right, you know. And we all know, yeah. You know, a lot of times, you know, you got to play the game right. But yeah, those first 4 years, I just don't know. But
you were rocking the boat. And that's, you know,
I was rocking the boat.
It might not be quite as egregious now, but I mean, those were different times back then too.
Yeah, I remember, and again, you got me telling stories that I usually don't tell, but I remember, you know, and this is the truth. If anybody thinks that I'm making this up, I'm not making it up. But every morning they would drop off a newspaper. On every squad got a newspaper. And at some point during the morning, you know, I was going through the newspaper. It's a newspaper. It's not like I was reading a woman's magazine.
Right.
And the next day I get a call from the supervisor asking me to come in to speak with him because he heard I was reading the newspaper. And I'm like, the newspaper that they drop off every morning that's full of news? And so I went in and he's telling me, and I said, well, my point is, who told you I was reading the newspaper and what is their agenda?
Right.
I mean, that to me is the most important thing. You know, what you're calling me in to talk about me reading the newspaper. You know, who's this who told you? Well, I didn't realize that the supervisor, I was just supposed to say, I'm sorry, and I won't read the newspaper that they drop off every morning anymore. But I didn't. I just went on, who is this person? Because I need to watch out for this person because obviously, you know, he's got something out against me. Well, I didn't know that the supervisor had gone to high school and college with the ASAC. And so the next morning, I'm not making this up. The next morning, I get called into the ASAC to say I was insubordinate to the supervisor.
Really?
But he's going to give me another chance. I'm going to be transferred to the applicant unit and where I will be able to look at the recruits that are coming in and look at them and say, do I really have what it takes to be an agent?
And you've got how much time on the job?
3 years, maybe. I'm already an agent.
Yeah. But that doesn't sound very logical.
No, I'm not making this up when I say it was because of a newspaper and me pushing back with, you know, why am I here? Is this real? You know, that you're and so, yeah. And so that's that 4th year is where I'm sitting on the applicant squad, mm-hmm. you know, doing background investigations, looking around saying like, you know, if this is what's going to keep happening, you know, right. And I'm fighting to say, you know, your perceived notions of my abilities and qualities are totally wrong, and I can't get people to see that, then maybe I just need to go.
Yeah.
So
it's very disheartening.
Oh, it's so disheartening. And I know that it happens to people, you know, a memo goes out, the memo from Quantico that said that, you know, I didn't respect the chain of command, you know, just probably started it downhill where people just made assumptions. But, you know, then this special agent in charge, who was one of the first African-American special agents in charge, came to me and wanted me to do recruiting. And he wanted me to do recruiting for him because it became part of their evaluation, how many women and minorities they were hiring at the time. And he, as one of the first African-American, Wayne Davis is definitely my mentor. He's no longer with us. But he, at the time, did not want to get, you know, a ding you know, being a bad evaluation on that aspect. And for some reason, even though everybody else is staying, you know, thinking that, you know, she can't do it, for some reason, he thought I could. And he wanted me to head up the management program or the hiring program for Philly. And again, during that time period, it's when I realized, you know, I was selected for this position because of my background, my education, my ability. You know, I will fight to stay here and prove everyone, you know, that I could do it. And yeah, so I had that second opportunity to shine, and I did, and you know, it continued.
Good for you. Now, how long was that assignment?
3 years.
Ooh.
3 years. And so I finally just went in. It was like 1987 by then, and just said, look, you know, having talked to these new agents and applicants about the wonderful work that we're doing, I need to get back to that. You know, I need to start doing that. You know, I need to start making the arrest and doing the search warrants and, you know, having the trials. And like I said, you know, I'm so glad that I stuck it out and I stood up for myself. And, you know, when I got back to working on economic crime, I, you know, ended up working on that same squad for over 11 years, you know, and was the, you know, the primary relief, the acting supervisor for a good part of it, and was in a position where I was able to help other agents on the squad, you know, figure out how to do work their cases. And I think, you know, you could speak to anybody from the Philadelphia division that worked those type of cases, and you know, they would say the same thing.
Oh, great. Well, now, was Wayne Davis still the SAC at that time?
Oh, no. He was probably only in charge for maybe half of the time that I was working, you know, on recruiting. And then another supervisor, another Wayne Gilbert came in, and he asked me to stay, and because he also didn't want to get a bad evaluation.
Right.
But eventually, you know, I helped him out, and then it was time to get back to what I joined the FBI to do.
Excellent.
Yeah.
Now, so when you say economic crimes, explain to our listeners what all that entails. I mean, It's more than fraud, right?
Right. Absolutely. So it is, of course, under the White Collar Crime Program. And as we all know, white collar crime is any type of criminal activity that involves basically business transactions. It's where, you know, somebody is engaged with an individual with the intention of defrauding them of either money or something, property of value, by using lies and deception. And so basically that covers economic crime, but you know, you got your Ponzi schemes, your advance fee schemes, your, embezzlements, you know, things like that, telemarketing fraud, all of that is covered under economic crime. And I worked all of it.
Wow. And I'm sure there's no shortage of business.
Oh, no shortage of business. Which is really kind of sad also, because the fact that there was no shortage of business, there were many times that we had to turn away people, you know, that may have been defrauded of $100,000. And it was like, it's not big enough. You know,
wow.
you haven't reached the economic threshold of the type of cases that the U.S. Attorney's Office is going to be willing to prosecute. Because, you know, I could investigate a case all day long, but if I don't have, you know, a prosecutorial opinion from the U.S. Attorney's Office that they're going to actually, you know, take it to trial, you know, if it gets that right. far, then what's the use of me investigating it? So many times, you know, we would get cases and I'd look into them and have to turn them down. So that was pretty sad.
It is. And, you know, as you're talking about this here, just a couple of years ago, my wife and I were having a fence put in our backyard, and the fence company, the guy seemed honest and everything, had great ratings. And, you know, we don't know a lot of people in Orlando. And so we had to send him an advance payment of $1,200, and it was, you know, to lock him in. And I noticed the email, you know, there was a new name on there, and I thought, well, that's his financial person, that, you know, whoever runs the finances of the company. And it was a scam. Somebody had cloned his email account, and they got me for $1,200. And I'm pissed, you know.
And there was no law enforcement agency that is going to investigate that unless you can show that he has scammed, you know, 100 people, and then they can put all of those together, all of those complaints together in one package, you know, of a higher value. Is that what happened?
Well, so the Narcos thing kind of came into play because I was friends with some deputies from Orange County deputies and some Orlando PD guys. And I mentioned it to – what I did is I called the ASAC here in Orlando for DEA, and I said, hey, you got any TFO task force officers with the county? Because I live in the county, not the city. And he's like, yeah, we got – you know, he introduced me to a guy. And of course, the ASAC told him who I was and the affiliation with Narcos and Pablo and all that stuff. And so that guy called me, and he's like, man, can I come by and, you know, let's talk about this. I said, sure, come on over to the house. And you can see I got all my – this is my – my ego walls everywhere. Well,
I got one too.
Yeah. And so he said, well, listen, I'm TFO for DEA, but I want to introduce you to our lead financial crime investigator for the Sheriff's Department. And the guy, he comes out to the house over this $1,200 scam. And
you're lucky. You know that, right? How lucky, how privileged you are to have someone look at it.
We talked about the crime for maybe 5 minutes, and then we talked about Narcos for about an hour. You know, and he's walking around looking at all the memorabilia that's in here. And believe it or not, they track it out to this suspect in Vegas. So then he said, well, we turned it over to Vegas Metro. And I got two calls from them that they never recalled, that never called back. I missed their calls when they called both times. Hey, we're with the Financial Crimes Unit at Vegas Metropolitan Police Department out here. We understand you got scammed, but we don't know all the details, and it doesn't sound like a very big case, but call us and let us know what's going on. And I still haven't heard back from them. They left two messages. I called them back twice, and they never returned the call. So, and I know 100% what you're saying is the only reason they even talked to me was because of Narcos. Right.
Okay. So it did turn out the way I thought it would. I thought, you were going to say they got the guy, and unfortunate, you know, when it comes to economic crime and fraud, most of the time, you know, people are going to get away with it. So if you want to make some money, you know, fraud may be the way to go. You know, as long as you keep it down low, you know, it's a good moneymaker, because, you know, we're only going to be looking at cases that, you know, have big, huge financial losses.
Right.
My Ponzi scheme, I worked initially, it was a $350 million Ponzi scheme.
Holy cow.
Now at the end, with clawback and, you know, and restitution, it ended up being like $130 million in actual loss. But yeah, initially, you know, the scheme took in $350 million.
Wow. And you just mentioned the term clawback. What's that mean?
Clawback is where the court demands that people who made out early in the scheme, who actually made money in this, you know, fake investment, return that money to the court so that it can be given to people who did not make out in the scheme. And so they claw it back.
Wow.
You know, which is, you know, you can imagine that if you've been in a Ponzi scheme. And of course, you know, the reason a Ponzi scheme works is because they take money from new people that come in order to provide it to people that have been in initially in order to keep the scheme flowing. And so those people at the beginning are all happy because, you know, this guy said he's going to, you know, give them back a 50%, you know, return, and they get it. And they spend it. And so when the court says, oh, no, you don't get to, you know, walk away with that ill-gotten money. You're going to have to give it back. That's very painful because, you know, that money is now a house, or that money is now, you know, a car or college education that, you know, they're going to have to give back.
Wow. You've heard of the company called Amway.
Oh, yeah. Right?
Is that a Ponzi scheme or not?
No, that's, what do they call that? It's the difference is it's an ML. It's been a while. So I'm having another senior moment, but it's like a Ponzi scheme. But instead of they're making their money by getting new recruits and new investors. And the right. people that are at the top then get a piece of each person that comes in into this new business. So it's similar, but it is not a basic Ponzi scheme in itself.
And the reason I ask is because I tried Amway when I was a city cop. You know, you did what you had to do to make ends meet. Mm-hmm. I never recruited a soul. I couldn't convince anybody to come on under me.
Most of those, multi-marketing. I'm trying to think of the name of it. And again, I'm having a senior moment. But most of those businesses don't make money from the actual product that they sell. They make money from recruiting people to sell that product. And that's how you can tell, that it's one of those schemes is if that's where the majority of the money comes from. Because when you come in as a new salesperson, you've got to buy the product, to show, your customers, and they sell more product to people that are going to be coming in as salesperson than they actually do to non-affiliated customers. And so that's where you know that it is a scheme.
Yeah. Yeah. I remember we went to that recruitment, dinner or whatever. And you're in this, multi-million-dollar house and you're just, and you're young. And
this
you're
could be you.
Yeah, exactly. Sucker. They got the fish upset.
Yeah, but I'm sure their sales tactic was not about how much product you were going to sell to customers.
Right.
But it was all about how you're going to convince other people to come into the program.
And not only that, the people you recruit, you want them to have a good sales personality because they're going to recruit and you're going to get a cut of that. And
it's just all about the recruitment of salespeople and not the marketing of the actual product.
Wow.
Yeah.
You kind of mentioned a temporary assignment you had in Cherry Hill, New Jersey. And I don't want to miss that because you were asked to go and be an acting supervisor. Is that right?
Oh, okay. Now that was much later.
Oh, was it?
Yeah, that was towards the end of my career. Now, I did mention it, but that was another time that I had been assigned to go over there to work on a mortgage fraud investigation. They needed extra bodies, and I went over there to do that, which is really funny. I'm using this opportunity to just complain about all these different things, but it was really funny because there were in Philadelphia, half of the office lives in South Jersey. Half of the office lives in Pennsylvania. I lived in Philadelphia. I was one of those agents who could walk to work if I wanted to, because I lived in the Queens Village area of Center City, Philadelphia. And when I get this call that I'm going to go work on this mortgage fraud investigation in New Jersey, and there are so many agents who live in New Jersey who would love not to have to cross the bridge, the Ben Franklin Bridge or the Walt Whitman Bridge every day to come into Philly. It again was one of those situations where I couldn't keep my mouth shut because it was like, what? I live in Philly. There are people dying. They would do whatever they needed to do, become somebody's butt boy.
Yeah, there you go.
In order to get this cushy assignment that's in New Jersey, but you're going to make me, who doesn't have a bureau car assigned to me. Anyway, here I go again.
Well, it is the irony of the situation. It makes no sense.
Yes. And so that was what was happening in the first 4 years. But I'm going to get off of that. I am not going to talk about anything bad that happened in the first 4 years. I had 26 years in the FBI. The first four sucked.
There you go. And 22 good years.
Yeah, but 22 excellent years. And so that Cherry Hill assignment that you're talking about, where I was the acting supervisor for 6 months, happened towards the end of my career. Do we want to talk about it now? Or?
Sure, because I don't want to forget. My senior moment will kick in.
Yeah. So I was on that one economic crime squad that I talked about for 11 years. And I really loved the work, had trials, had convictions, had just worked a group 2 undercover investigation that I was leading with lots of consensual calls. And, you know, it was so much fun. But I had an opportunity to transfer to the Cherry Hill office. I lived in New Jersey. And again, I wanted to take advantage of that opportunity to work in New Jersey. And so I had an opportunity to go out there and work fraud cases in New Jersey. And so I was working out there probably for 3 or 4 years. And at some point, the supervisor became an ASAC. And because, you know, again, I was the primary relief at the time, I became the acting supervisor for the last, for 6 months. But it was poor timing, good timing on his part. He got out of there, but it was just before the inspection.
Oh.
And so the FBI, I don't know how often, but every 3 years or so, they would have an inspection where big wigs from inspectors from FBI headquarters would come to a division and go through everything. You know, look at the number of cases, the quality of cases, the money that's being spent, what's happening undercover, making sure everybody was, you know, doing what they were supposed to do. And so now during my 6 months as the acting supervisor, I've got to prepare the office with the interrogatories and all this stuff for the inspection. Not fun.
That's one of the worst jobs you can have.
Oh, it was just terrible. You know, it's all about paperwork and statistics and justifications. And it was just, I just sat there thinking, like, I will never apply for a supervisory position again, because I had applied. I had applied to be the supervisor of the squad that I was on for 11 years and didn't get it, and which was one of the reasons I decided to move on. But having that opportunity to be the acting supervisor just before the inspection made me understand that I wanted to be the supervisor of the squad I was on, since I was doing a lot of that work anyway, but right, I did not really want to be a supervisor.
So it all worked out in the end, but
I mean, it all worked out at the end.
Those inspections, they get so tedious, they even go out to your G car and, okay, have you got a fire extinguisher? Have you got this?
Yes.
You got that? It gets ridiculous.
And then when the person, so I was there for, like I said, for the months leading up to it and during the inspection. And so, you know, when somebody comes in and there is something, you know, that is wrong, then you have to sit there and write the memo and the justification. And it was, I was like, oh no.
Yeah.
Oh
yeah.
No.
Somebody else can do this.
Yeah. This is not fun.
Yeah.
But I did get a call because, you know, they were now going to be looking for, they did, because the inspection was coming, they did not put out, you know, they didn't advertise the job, you know, so that's why I had it for 6 months, because it just didn't make any sense to bring somebody new and when, you know, when there was going to be an inspection. And right. So after the inspection, the special agent in charge wanted to know, did I want to apply for that position? Because now it's open. Or, which was like, surprise, surprise, did I want to come back into Philly to be the media rep, the spokesperson for the FBI, a position that most offices don't even have anymore. But I had already been the backup. I'd been working as the backup media person for years, you know, and I was like, I'm coming back. Raising my hand. I don't want to be a supervisor anymore. I will become the spokesperson and take that job.
That's excellent. The DEA had public information officers, you know, and
were they DEA agents?
Initially. Now they actually have professionals coming.
Yes. Yeah. So that was the case with the FBI too. Initially, when I was going through, it was always an agent. You know, a veteran agent who really knew the workings of the FBI was being the spokesperson, really representing the SAC, writing, you know, press releases and doing all of that. Now it is a public affairs or, you know, specialist, usually a former reporter, but they're not doing the same type of work that we used to do. Like, I understand now that they don't write press releases that comes out of the United States Attorney's Office. We, you know, they don't necessarily hold press conferences and have the same type of relationship that the media rep, the spokesperson agent used to have, you know, with the media during my time period. But I love that job. Yeah. And I did that job for my last 4.5 years that I was in the Bureau.
Nice. Very nice.
Yes.
Well, going back to your economic crimes investigations, what's tell us about a case that you think was the most exciting case that you ever worked on and what made it so exciting?
Well, it was really strange because, again, I'm an economic crime agent, a fraud agent, and I am working this Group 2 undercover investigation, which I worked for probably 3 or 4 years, where it was a business-to-business telemarketing fraud, where they had businesses throughout Philadelphia that were involved in this scam. It was called a light bulb scam, but they sold industrial and maintenance products to companies throughout the country. But it was all a fraud because it was either overbilling, you know, or it was inferior products, or it was selling products that you never even shipped. Because part of the scheme was them to bribe the procurement officer at these country at these companies. And so somebody would do a cold call into the company, find out who the procurement officer was, and then tell them that they would send them gift certificates, you know, to Sears for big screen TVs, refrigerators, riding lawnmowers, washing machines, for their personal use, you know, if they were interested in approving invoices from the maintenance industrial company. And so they would have the procurement officer in their pocket, and they would just invoice them for stuff that was ridiculous. It was called Operation Duct Tape. Because one of the things that they sold was, you know, rolls of duct tape that would be, you know, $250 at Home Depot, and they'd sell it for $25 or $50 a roll. And then they send them thousands of rolls of duct tape, you know, to the point where the procurement officer or the maintenance man or whoever was in charge of buying the stuff would have to hide it because, you know, they had a supply closet full of stuff that was ridiculous, you know. Because once they were in, you know, once they got caught up in the scam, the companies would just keep sending out product.
You really want to be better with your finances. You try to put money away in savings. You look for deals. You wrote out a budget once a long time ago. Yet you still overdraft from time to time and you still have debt. The truth is, managing money is not easy, but Rocket Money can help. Rocket Money shows you exactly what you're spending every month. From there, the app helps you make a budget that meets your financial goals. The app even gives you real-time alerts when you're about to go over your budget so you don't spend too much. With Rocket Money, you can also see all of your subscriptions at a glance and cancel the ones you don't want right from the app. Rocket Money can even try to get you a refund for some of the money you wasted. Plus, you can use the smart savings feature to start putting more money away. Rocket Money analyzes your accounts to determine the optimal time to stow away cash without going over your budget. Our members report that the Rocket Money app saved them more than $700 a year. Getting better with money doesn't have to be a pipe dream. Rocket Money can make it a reality. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel or download the app from the Apple App or Google Play stores.
Step into the world of power, loyalty, and luck.
I'm going to make him an offer he can't refuse.
With family, cannolis, and spins mean everything.
Now, you want to get mixed up in the family business.
Introducing The Godfather at ChumbaCasino.com. Test your luck in the shadowy world of The Godfather slot.
Someday, I will call upon you to do a service for me.
Play The Godfather now at ChumbaCasino.com.
Welcome to the family.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 21 plus. Terms and conditions apply.
So that was the case. And I loved that case, and it was very, very successful. We did a search warrant. We did 2 days of search warrants where we went out and notified and searched 14 different companies over a 2-day period.
Because
again, this was a Philadelphia, the light bulb. You know, I read something where, what's his name? The Seinfeld. Well, that was one of the jobs that he had when he was young as an actor, were doing these telemarketing, selling light bulbs and supplies as a telemarketer online. So it was a really big thing. And for some reason, New York, Philadelphia really persisted in the scheme. But that was the case. But I had one company come in, and there were two brothers, and they came in to for a proffer, you know, to talk about their business and the fact that we had searched, you know, their business and closed them down because they were doing this the scheme. And the attorney says, after the proffer has gone real well and things look good, he said, "Well, are you going to tell her about the them shooting the shotgun?" Or not the shotgun, the gunshot. And I'm like, "What are you talking about?" And this company had gotten into an extortion, a credit extortion problem with some associate members of the Philly mob. They had they would have outstanding invoices that they know they're going to get paid for. And so they would get checks that they would take to this credit check cashing place. And, you know, sometimes the checks would bounce. And so now they had to get a loan out from the check cashing place. And they had just gotten into way over their head. You know, they owed so much money because, of course, there were some, you know, ridiculous credit, interest that they were owed on this. And so at some point, the people who owned the cash checking agency came into their office and demanded their money. And to make sure they understood, they took out a gun and shot a hole right past this guy's head into the wall of his office.
Ooh.
And so I'm sitting there at this proffer saying, like, whoa. You know, I'm a fraud investigator. I better call, you know, some of my friends over in the organized crime squad. But when they got to it, they said that this guy is not a made member. He's not one of our targets. They're an associate. The three guys were DeSuma, D'Amelia, and Delilia. You know, all names that end in A. Frank DeSuma was the guy that shot the shot the gun to convince him that they were serious. And so in the middle of this big telemarketing case, I'm now working an extortion case. And it was so much fun. You know, it's a little bit different than what I would do. And it ended up that I got one of the guys from the organized crime squad I had been his training agent on my squad before he transferred. Derek Workmeister came over to work the case with me. So we ended up working it together. And it was great because these guys were meeting in, you know, different restaurants where the bad guys were trying to convince them to pay the money that they owed. And they met at a restaurant called, and I love the name of this restaurant, I need to use it in a book one day, Benny the Bums.
Okay.
If anybody from Philadelphia, I think Benny the Bum still exists. And so they would meet at the restaurant. And at one time, I get so excited when I talk about this case because it was so fun for me because it was not something I normally do. But at one point, they take him into the bathroom. Now, I got them all wired up and I even got a transmitter on them. We're out in the parking lot listening to, you know, the threats that are being made. Well, they take him into the bathroom and made them strip. They were doing a strip search and they had a wand that indicated that there's, you know, the wand lit up, like they said, like a Christmas tree. And so they knew something was going on. And so they ended the meeting. We had met with them at least twice before and had gotten these consensual recordings of the threats. This was the last time. And it was like, well, how do they know? What's, you know, what's going on? You know, but they ended the meeting and they take my transmitter with them.
The bad guys did.
The bad guys did. And so I go back to the office and I let the, you know, ASAC know that the transmitter was taken. And he's like, well, you got to go get it. And I'm like, well, I'm still working the case. He said, well, that's a lot of money and you got to go get it. And so now we've got to wrap this case up. Luckily, you know, it was like our third recording and we basically had the information. And so it was like an overnight meeting with Darren Workmeister, myself, and the strike force attorney, Dave Fritchie, you know, to get the affidavit together and to be able to get a, you know, search and arrest warrants, and which we did the next day. And I remember walking into the check cashing business and saying to the guy, you know, that we're here for a search and, you know, that you're under arrest and that you have something that belongs to me. And he's like, oh, what are you talking about? And I tell him about the transmitter, and in his office, in a glass of water, is the transmitter. So I was able to go back to the ASAC and say, look, I got your transmitter back.
That's accountable property.
Yeah, but I don't think it's any good anymore.
Well, when they found the transmitter, did they not do anything to the guy that was wearing the transmitter?
No, because I guess they assumed that we were listening.
Yeah.
But they did take it, you know. And you know what? We found out at the end, and all of this can be verified because I had the two brothers on my podcast.
No kidding.
Yes. I had such a good relationship with them that, you know, as I'm doing the podcast, I found out that one of them is listening to the podcast. He comments on something on LinkedIn. And so I contacted them. And so they come on the podcast. So they're telling all of this story on the podcast. But we found out that the reason that the bad guys knew that he was cooperating with us is because his father-in-law, who was in the middle of a divorce, who hated his guts, it was Gary, the brother named Gary, told the bad guys. He knew the check cashers. He knew that, you know, that the what was going on. And so he called them and said that he was working with the FBI and he's wired. And so that's when they called this meeting. They immediately took him to the bathroom and made him strip.
You know, the motivation behind these guys, it's yeah.
His it's father-in-law just like hated him that much.
Wow. Yeah. Wow.
Anyway, that was a great case. You know, yeah. We went to one of them pled guilty, or two of them pled guilty, but the one who shot the gun, Frank D'Souza, is it Frank? Yeah, I think he was the one who shot the gun. Was a convicted felon, so you know, Yufa, he shouldn't have had the gun in the first place, and so he did go to trial. To fight that, it was worth it for him to do that. And so, yeah, they all got some time. I think Frank might've got 20 years and
wow.
It's for all my cases that I have agents talk about are my cases. I make sure I have newspaper articles and court documents to, you know, for people who want to take a deeper dive. But, I don't know what number episode it is, but it's under check cashing. So if you are on my website and you search for check cashing, they'll be able to pull it up. But that case was so much fun because it was different than anything that I had worked before. The one guy, we actually arrested him, you know, outside a Philadelphia strip club that, you know, kind of just adds a little more spice, to the case.
Sounds like a good TV show, doesn't it?
Yeah, it would have been perfect.
And just for our listeners here, that's the FBI Case File Review is Jerry's podcast. And I highly encourage you listen to these cases. One more question. What would you consider the most dangerous case you ever worked in your career?
You know, I would not say that I myself was the case agent of a dangerous case. But as I said, I went out to work in the Cherry Hill office for 3 or 4 years towards the end of my career. And that office investigated or under their jurisdiction was Camden, New Jersey.
That's a tough place.
Yeah, it was a very, very tough place. And so there were many, many drug investigations. And as a Black female, you know, they asked me to go out on every last one of the searches and arrests that they were conducted. And I went out on every last one of those drug cases that the Cherry Hill office did during that 3 to 4 year period. I just think it, in some situations, and most of those cases, we work with local law enforcement also on a task force. But I just think it was, and I recognize the value of me being able to go out and maybe talk to, you know, some of the subjects as far as convincing them to cooperate. Many situations where you're going into a home and the wives and girlfriends who are not actively involved, you know, are there. There's children there. And so I recognize the fact that there was value in me, you know, going out on those arrests and searches to, you know, talk to the people and kind of get them to calm down and to understand, you know, what was going to be happening. And I loved that part of the job. And one of the best things that I would say that I was able to do during my career is work a case with one of the drug agents. It was a mortgage fraud case where it was almost like Stringer Bell from The Wire, where this drug dealer was trying to use his drug proceeds to do a legitimate business, and which was his girlfriend sold real estate. He would buy houses trying to flip them, but he was selling them to people that couldn't afford them, and it was a mortgage fraud case. And so I worked that case together with the drug agent. And one of the best things that I'm proud about is being able to turn one of those drug dealers and help him. He was cooperating with us, help him see the light and become a, you know, a proud contributor to the community and actually attend PTA meetings with his sons, who he was able to get custody of. And I actually was able, when I became the spokesperson, the media person, to get the Philadelphia Inquirer to do an article about this guy and the transition that he had made. And so I'm very proud of that. I wish I knew where he was today, but being able to work that case over a 2 or 3 year period and see him grow from being a drug dealer who had 4 kids that, you know, he was not supporting, to a person who I was able to encourage to get DNA tests, paternity tests, find out only 2 of them were his, and then to go ahead and file for custody of those 2 kids, take them, move to Delaware, get a good job, and begin supporting them and again, becoming a member of the PTA.
That is not something to be glossed over.
No.
Because everybody thinks that law enforcement, all we're going to do is put people in jail and throw away the key. When you have an opportunity like that, that's something to really be proud of in your career. I love the fact that you brought that story to light, because that was the last question I was going to ask you, is which one were you most proud of? And it sounds like that's the one.
Oh, that's the one. And I need to give a shout out to Jim Smith, who was the FBI agent that I worked with. He passed away last year. And so I want to make sure, I would have loved to have him on the podcast so we could talk about that case together. And maybe I'll get the AUSA one day to come. But Jim had an accident. He fell and hit his head. And so his last years were really rough. You know, he was in a wheelchair and having problems, cognitive problems. And so I was never able to, you know, get him on the show as a guest so that we could talk about that case together. But I am so proud of the Kenny Jenkins drug and mortgage fraud investigation that we worked together.
Excellent. So at the end of your career, why did you decide to leave the Bureau?
Because I got a job offer that I could not resist.
That's great.
Yeah. So I'm now working as the spokesperson and the media person for, like I said, four and a half years. It's 2008. And I always said that if I left the Bureau, I would love to continue working in media relations, and that the best job that I could think of would be to work for SEPTA, which is the Southeastern Pennsylvania Transit Authority, because I knew it's the transit system in Philadelphia. And there's a lot of retired agents and retired law enforcement that start working for transit authorities. And I knew that that'd be a great job because they had their own police force. And so I could still be doing media relations and law enforcement. And I mean, I said it number of times, and I worked with SEPTA sometimes when the FBI had a suspicious package or something happened that they would have to call the FBI in. And so I get this call one day saying that they were looking for, you know, somebody for their media department, and would I like to apply? And I was like, yes. I had at that time 26 years. I was 51, you know, you can't retire. I came in early, came in at 25. And so I had to stay until I was at least 55 in order to have those 20 years. And it was, I had 21 in, and I applied and got the job. And I loved that job. I worked that job for 7 years post FBI. It was 24/7. You know, we were always, SEPTA was always, you know, hitting somebody and killing them by running them over with a bus. Or there was always some type of suicide by train or an assault, a physical assault or shooting on the system. And so I was always talking to the media, you know, getting called, sometimes walking outside my house to meet the reporter to do, you know, a live coverage of whatever happened. I loved the job, but it got to a point where I realized I'm retired. I don't have to work this hard anymore. And it was, I had also written a book that, again, this, you know, that I was interested in, you know, publishing and getting it out there. And I hated the boss.
Yeah.
You know, I loved my first boss, that I was working with at SEPTA, but the second one, the head of the big boss, you know, whose office I was right down. You know, when you're the media person, you're right up there with all of the big wigs. And I shouldn't have said I hated him. I liked him as a person, but it was difficult to work on some of the things he was working on. And so I decided, you know what, I don't have to do this. And I left, but I love SEPTA. I love SEPTA today. They're having some, you know, financing issues, but it's a good agency. You know, the trains, the buses, the subways, and the trolleys, and I love using public transportation as I travel around the world because I am a convert.
All right, and I'm very fortuitous that that position was open when you decided to retire.
Well, I didn't. I only retired because the position was open. Yeah, I probably would have still been there for a few more years.
Mm-hmm. And you, I'm going to guess as a result of your podcast, but you became a technical advisor for some TV shows and film. Anything we've heard of, and what was your responsibility in those roles?
Yeah. So because of the podcast, and I really don't talk about current events. You know, when I'm talking on, you know, to the media, I'm usually talking about the FBI and books, TV, and movies. I mean, that's what my best-selling book, FBI Myths and Misconceptions, is all about. And so somebody heard of me, and I worked as a technical advisor on the show Class of 09. And, you know, dealing directly with the executive producer, Tom Rob Smith. I loved Class of 09, reading the scripts and working with him on getting the FBI right. And then around the same time, I get this email, and the email subject line says, consultation on J.J. Abrams show. And I thought, oh, God, this has got to be a scam. You know, and I open it up, and it's somebody interested in talking with me about being an FBI, person, doing consulting on this J.J. Abrams show, which is Duster, which came out this year. And so I started working, and I'm telling you, I am doing Zoom meetings with J.J. Abrams. This is before they even started writing the scripts, just talking to him about, what an FBI agent. It's about the first black female FBI agent. And so a lot of the stuff in the actual script ended up being very close to my life and the things that happened to me. You'll see, if you ever watch the show that, came out this year, you'll see some of that. And it was just so much fun. I was paid nicely,
Yeah.
And I was paid, my contract was for every episode and every season that that show would run. And unfortunately, the show did not get a second season. So yeah. my cash cow money opportunity just dried up.
Yeah, but what a unique opportunity. I mean, not every law enforcement person gets an opportunity to do something like that.
Yeah, it was so much fun. And just being able to read the scripts and work with them on that helped me a lot as an author myself, trying to write crime novels. I learned a lot from J.J. Abrams directly and from LaToya Morgan, who is also the producer and scriptwriter from that. It was a great experience, and I still love the show.
That's very cool. Very cool.
Yeah.
Again, some similarities in our lives.
Yes, indeed, because we've all had a little taste of Hollywood. I've actually, worked with a group of producers on pitching for a TV show. It's hard.
It is. So
we went out to everyone. I was the main pitch person, talking about what the show concept, and we went out to everyone, Disney, Netflix, BET, it was about six or seven, that we did pitches with, and nobody bought the show, but it was fun, just working on the concept and the possibility was exciting.
It is. And doing something different. I like doing new things.
Yeah.
When you started your podcast now in 2016, is that right?
January of 2016.
How did you come up with the idea and, why a podcast?
Well, at the time, my literary agent was saying that I needed to build a platform because, publishing, they look for good books, but they also look for people that could help them sell those good books. So right. What is your platform? How can you help us sell this book? And so he wanted me to start building my platform. And a lot of people were blogging at the time. So I know podcasts have been around for a long time, but really 2014 with the introduction of Serial really is where true crime took off. And so at the end of 2015, when I have left, I left SEPTA in November of 2015 to start working on getting this book out. And I thought about blogging, and then I thought, now true crime podcast, let me do a podcast. And the concept of it being me interviewing retired FBI agents was just a transition from my bureau time as a spokesperson, where in that last year, 2008, was the 100th anniversary of the FBI. And so I spent a lot of time interviewing agents for the historical video that I did, at the 100th anniversary. And so the concept came to me a lot, very quickly. I was also the vice chairman of the Retired Agents Association, the Society of Former Special Agents of the FBI, was the vice chair of the Philadelphia chapter. And so I knew all these retired agents. I had access to them. And so, I decided to do a podcast where I did case reviews. I didn't want to do interviews about, the agents' careers, because a lot of people were doing those type of interviews, which is great. I wanted to come in with a single case, focus on that case, and then at the end, ask my standard question of when and why you joined the FBI. So the concept was there from the very beginning. And yesterday I posted my 377th episode.
Wow. That's huge.
Yeah.
That is huge. And now, and like you say, you're coming up on your 10-year anniversary.
No, go ahead. I'm sorry.
I was going to say, what was it? Was it the allure of the FBI name in the title of your podcast? What was, how did you grow? Because you're, I looked you up on Listen Notes this morning. You're in the top 0.1% of over 3 million podcasts worldwide.
The reason, and that and that's point, I think it might be 0.01%.
Yeah, I think you're right.
Yeah. Two things that I had no control over. Well, first of all, it was the name. I said FBI case file review. So if you search for FBI, any FBI podcast, boom, mine's the first one that comes up. You know, I could have called, FBI could have been at the end and that wouldn't happen. But because I have FBI at the beginning of my name, it's the first one that pops up. And right. So, of course, more people are learning about it because if they're interested in, you know, something about the FBI, it pops up right away. I would like to say that that was a strategic move on my part, but it it wasn't. I just decided to call it FBI. And then, again, had no control over this. About 3 weeks or 3 or 4 weeks into starting the podcast, iTunes, which was Apple Podcasts, what they called it at the time, selected it as one of their new and noteworthy podcasts, and they highlighted it on the front page of the iTunes website. And I'm telling you, I went from a few hundred that were listening a week to 25,000 people wow. who were listening to it. Now that number dwindled down to like 5,000. And again, this is like in February or March of 2016. You know, some people listened to it and liked it and, but left. Some people listened to it, didn't like it and left, but then, but some people stayed. And so from the very beginning, I had at least 5,000 people a week listening to that. And I've grown it since then by just being persistent and consistent.
Very good. And that's words of wisdom for any would-be podcaster that's out there. Because it's that's if you do your research, that's the first thing they say is be consistent.
Yep.
And it's a pain in the butt, to be quite it's honest a pain with in you. The butt.
Now, you do more shows than I do. I mean, I try to do 3 to 4 a month. And, you know, I'd like to have a week off during the month. So, you know, I don't do one every week. You know, I may do 3 and then I take a week off just because there's other things I want to do. And this is so time consuming, but you do some more than once a week.
Well, it's the content you do bonus episodes. The Patreon thing just takes so much time, but you know, you're always looking for content on that. But, I'm not complaining at all. I mean, it is a lot of work. It's every 7 days a week, I'm doing something on the podcast.
Oh, absolutely. It is definitely, people don't understand, it's a 7-day-a-week thing. Because even if I'm not interviewing somebody, then I'm putting together show notes or I'm scheduling people to come on to the podcast, you know, next month or next, you know, next year. There's always something that you're doing. I love it.
Well, and then, and with, you know, with the other avenues of social media, you're making clips for, to put on Instagram and TikTok and X and Facebook. And man, when I retire from DEA, you could not find me on social media.
Yeah, that's the truth. I would not be on social media. I think it's a very toxic place to be. So I probably wouldn't even be on social media if it wasn't for this show. And so I do go on and be personal, personable and, you know, highlight the things that I'm doing. But I try to stay away from politics and, yes. and all of that negativity stuff because I don't need that in my life.
That's the truth. I'm with you. Yeah. I'm with you there. Yeah. One thing I do want to mention, and I'm going to guess that you've received numerous awards throughout your career, but in 2021, you were recognized by something very special, weren't you?
Very special.
Tell us about that.
Yeah. So I get this call, and it is the president Brian O'Hare of the FBI Agents Association. And it's like the FBI union of current agents. Mm-hmm. You know, they represent over, I think it's like 90% of current FBI agents. And he tells me that I have been nominated to receive the FBI Agents G-Man Honors, you know, honoring FBI Heroes Distinguished Service Award for telling FBI stories.
Wow.
Again, I suffered from imposter syndrome. I thought to myself, this has got to be a joke. Because before that, the year before, the person who received that award was Dr. Senior Moment. What's the COVID doctor's name?
That starts like Kevorkian.
No, not the same. Dr. Fauci.
There you go.
Look at us, both having senior moments about the same thing. Yeah, and before that, it was a general or, you know, a director of the CIA, and it was like, what? But I just happened to be at a moment where the FBI, because of controversy and partisan politics, and people didn't like the fact that it was Dr. Fauci, they decided not to have outside people receive this award anymore, that they had more than enough agents that could receive this award, that they were going to change to agents. And so they picked me because of the podcast and the work that I was doing to, you know, show the public who the FBI is and what the FBI does. And so it was just a magical evening at the Four Seasons in Washington, D.C., where I got to sit with director Christopher Wray and then give the keynote speech. It's just amazing. It was just amazing.
It's exciting. I get goosebumps here. And when you mentioned the G-Man Award, I've never shown this on the podcast here. And you're only, for those of y'all that are listening, you got to go watch this on YouTube if you want to see this. When I left the Special Operations Division, This is a gift from the FBI, Washington, and you can't see it. I don't know if you can see it, but it says the G-Man. And you can see that's the old G-Man. It's got the FBI badge there on the front of it.
All right. I got to go get mine now, okay?
Yeah, absolutely.
Hold on for a minute. It's the same one.
Is that? Yeah, well, yours is a little bit bigger, and it's got a nice plaque, but still, it's still the same concept.
Yeah.
Fantastic. And it's got the old Tommy gun.
Yeah. Yep. And it's got the seal and everything. Yeah, this is the award that I got. Oh, it's a little dusty. Don't look at that. But this is just so special for me.
When you're recognized by your own colleagues, for me, there's no higher honor. So the fact that you are respected and thought of that highly within the organization, despite the challenges throughout your career, what an honor. I mean, just a true, true honor.
And, you know, and this is a great way to do a full circle moment, because I did spend so much of this interview, you know, talking about the issues and problems and troubles and, you know, that I had earlier in my career. But it's worth talking about that and being real and honest, because at the end, you know, I'm the spokesperson for the Philadelphia office. I'm the person who initially thought maybe this wasn't the right place for me, who was initially told maybe the FBI is not the right place for me. And at the end, I'm the spokesperson representing the FBI. And then after I retire, I get this award from the FBI Agents Association because of my love of the FBI and my support of the FBI. And so that's why it's important to tell those stories, to show people that if you just stick it out, that if you're tough, that you're persistent, that you know you belong, that you know you have something of value to offer, that it will all work out at the end.
Absolutely. And that's one of the things we talk about here on the show is you never give up.
Never give up.
What never a great legacy to leave. It's very awe-inspiring. And so one more question for you, and then I'm going to let you go. Before you go, though, do you have any thoughts or words of wisdom that you might want to offer to anybody who's considering a career in law enforcement or as a first responder or just anything in general that you'd like to leave the listeners with?
It is the most noble and satisfying position, job in the world. You know, you may not make a lot of money, but every day you can go home knowing that you have contributed to the world, to humanity, that you've helped someone, and that the bottom line is the people who really know what law enforcement and first responders do, they know that you are giving your all, you're sacrificing not only your time with your family, but sometimes your mental health, and that you're doing it all for the folks that you work for, the American people.
There you go. You know, we worked as public servants our entire professional careers. And for listeners that listen to this all the time, hear me say it repeatedly. Some people look at that term public servant as a derogatory term. I don't. I look at it as a badge of honor because we chose to serve our fellow man. And if you look at the book of instructions, which is called the Holy Bible, it'll tell you there's no greater calling. Okay.
No greater calling.
So, what a hoot to have you on here, Jerry. I think I've smiled the entire interview, which is fine. That's a good thing. But to have somebody of your caliber with your experience who is recognized by their own colleagues is a gift and a true honor. So thank you so much for coming on here.
Well, thank you for having me. Your career is also inspiring, what you've done. And so it's my honor to be here today and to know that we're fellow podcasters working together. So it's exciting. Thank you for having me.
Yes, ma'am. And before you go here, if you guys want to find out more about Jerry Williams, her podcast again is the FBI Case File Review. Highly recommended. I mean, I highly recommend it. Just even if you just go listen to one episode, go check it out and see what she's got going there.
Thank you.
When Morgan and I were planning this one, The Game of Crimes, hers is one of the podcasts we listen to first to see, okay, how do you do this? How do you conduct an interview? Wow. What are the ideas? So thank you for that, Jerry. On Instagram, you can find her at Jerry Williams and the number one. And Jerry is spelled J-E-R-R-I. Okay. So it's Jerry Williams one. And you can also find FBI Case File Review. And I'm putting a plaque up here so you can see this because you're not going to remember all this. On Facebook, you can find her at Jerry Williams-Wert, W-E-R-T.
No, that's my personal one. So it's Jerry Williams Author.
There you go.
My author page.
Very good. Thank you for correcting that. On TikTok, FBI Case File Review. On X, Jerry Williams 1 and FBI Case File Review. On LinkedIn, Jerry Williams and FBI Case File Review. And her website. Go check out this website because I got a website. It's not nearly as good as hers, okay? And that's jerrywilliams.com. I'm looking at it right now. There's everything on here from her bio to all the books that she's done to access to the podcast, to her blog. She's got news and events on there, reader team newsletter. And the one thing I really like is you got this thing on there called Buy Me a Cup of Coffee.
Yeah.
I love coffee. That's just cool.
Yep.
Who doesn't?
Yep. Coffee.
There you go. So come on over and check her out. Support her on her podcast. You know, this is what we do. I'm not in competition with Jerry. She's certainly not in competition with me. But we were fellow brother and sister law enforcement professionals. And in retirement, that brotherhood and that sisterhood continues. Do I pick on the Bureau? Does. Of course I do. Do they pick on DEA? Of course they do. But that's the camaraderie between agents. It's nothing personal. You know, I say this on the Patreon side all the time. It's okay for people to have differences of opinions. That doesn't mean we have to be enemies. We all have independent minds. God gave us a brain to make up our own decisions. So just keep that in mind. Yeah. So for all the listeners, again, thank you so much for continuing to come back every week. If you're listening to this on audio and you haven't checked us out on YouTube yet, do me a favor. Go over to YouTube, type in Game of Crimes Podcast in the search bar, hit the subscribe button. We just went over the 2,000 subscriber mark, which for me is huge. I've been working on that all year. But come over and check it out. Listen and watch some of the podcast interviews. Meet the guests. See what they look like. Hit the like button and send me your comments. Not sure what's wrong with you people, but I do know why you keep coming back every week. It's because you enjoy playing the biggest, the baddest, the most dangerous game of all, and that's the game of crimes. God bless. See y'all next week.
Hello, it is Ryan, and we could all use an extra bright spot in our day, couldn't we? Just to make up for things like sitting in traffic, doing the dishes, counting your steps, you know, all the mundane stuff. That is why I'm such a big fan of Chumba Casino. Chumba Casino has all your favorite social casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere with daily bonuses. So sign up now at chumbacasino.com. That's chumbacasino.com.